Okay, these maps that I've handed out to you, this is just covering 2 Samuel. There's a couple there on 1 Samuel at the end, but this will just cover 2 Samuel. What I've done online is I made these maps about 20 years ago because I kept teaching through the Old Testament year after year, and I keep drawing up the maps each time I taught class. I thought, I'm just going to make a map through the whole thing. So I ended up with about 270 maps through the Old Testament. I mean, just hand-drawn, nothing fancy, but enough to kind of communicate the story and the general idea. And I've just about got them all online, which means if you go to my homepage, generationword.com, then there's some little blue boxes somewhere on there. One that says Galen's Old Testament Maps. You click that, that will open up a page that has got each, every map, a small image of the map. If you click on that map, it'll open up a bigger one that you can actually read. And it's all the way through, the whole thing. You can cut and paste those. You can drag them off and use them in notes if you wanted to, or just use them for reference. It's pretty neat. I mean, I use these all the time, and I just thought this would be better to have it here instead of me just trying to scribble on the board and you trying to keep up. I just thought this would be better. We're going to go through 2 Samuel tonight. We went tried to go through 1 and 2 Samuel last week. I do realize this is an overview of the Old Testament, and I have a great weakness for slowing down, but we're not going to slow down much, but more than we could. We could just kind of breeze through. Last time we went through the Bible school series, we did the Old Testament in 6 weeks, I think. So we're just flying. We've kind of hit a couple snags here with some details, and again, that's part of my weakness of what I'm doing here. But we'll get through 2 Samuel, then we'll get into the kings. Hopefully next week we'll do the kings of Israel, the northern kings, and come down and do the southern kings the following week, kings of Judah. Let's bow our heads, I'll pray, and then we'll get started. Father, we come to you tonight in the name of Jesus, and we do thank you for the chance to be here. We thank you for your word, for the truth that you presented to us and recorded. We ask that we may hear these things, that we may put these events in perspective, that we may draw understanding from them, that we can gain wisdom from them, but we can also see who you are and the character that you have and how you want us to live. We thank you for this chance to study your word. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. So we are in 2 Samuel. And as we ended up last week, we'll be looking at your maps here. Their pages, the best thing to do is the pages are numbered in the bottom right corner. Well, go ahead. If you want to flip over way on the back, we'll do that real quick. This is just something I scribbled up real quickly. And what we have here is just a list of some people that are going to play into our story tonight. And you can refer to this as we go. First of all, at the bottom, David's got a general named Joab. Joab's mother's name is Zariah. She is David's sister. And there are three brothers, Joab, Abishai, and Ashiel. And these guys are, well, they're three brothers. They'd be David's nephews. These two particularly are, they're all warriors. This guy is known as being fleet-footed, fast. He gets killed early here in the book by Abner, the general of the northern 10 tribes. But Joab is going to be the general for David. And it's a very interesting study to watch Joab and David interact. Because Joab is really, he may be a better leader. He may be a better politician. Not necessarily a more godly man, although he does mention God and talk about God. He is just more practical. David and one sometimes will follow his emotions or try and, you know, he's a little more, maybe even want to say, if you want to call David gentle, he's a little more, David's a little more gentle, where Joab can see through the issues and he goes right for the source and deals with it. He prevents a lot of problems from arising. If David were without Joab, we may have a completely different story of David, because David, I think, would have made more mistakes without Joab. You read the book, you make your own decision. But he was a great general. We'll see how he goes. Again, he did some things that weren't, you're not going to be very happy with him as you go through the book, but he does some things that save some problems. Abishai is going to be one of David's three mighty men. He's going to have, we'll have a list of them at the end of the book of 2 Samuel of David gathered men around him. He had the three mighty men, which were not counted with the 30. Then there was these special 30 that were his best warriors that traveled with him. But then he's going to have another group of Philistines that have come over with him that are going to be his own personal bodyguard. So David, when he moved, it wasn't just David going around with a sling. He was moving with a bodyguard surrounded by the 30 best mighty men. And these guys had killed giants themselves. These guys, we're going to see, are going to be able to fight and defend fields by themselves. I mean, as the Philistines are attacking, they're doing things similar to Samson. As we get towards the end of the book, we'll see that these guys are great warriors. And so then, of course, above those 30 there was the three, and Abishai was one of those. So these guys are, again, this is a book about a lot of things. It's about God and David and his character. It's about the forming of the kingdom. But it's filled with war. It's filled with battles. And one thing that always impresses me, and I know it will impress you too, and I know you know this, but it's worth saying, when these guys went to battle, they went to battle in hand-to-hand combat. And Joab is going to live to be an old man, as is David. They're eventually going to pull David off the front lines when he hits about 45 years old. He almost gets killed. I think he runs out of gas one day, and he's going to get killed by somebody. And someone has to jump down into the pit where he's getting ready to be killed by a Philistine and kill the guy and save David. And the army says, David, you are done. You are going into retirement. You know, there's no Cal Ripken record for you. You're going to go back and stay in Jerusalem. But David wanted to keep going. I mean, can you imagine, I know you've thought about this, but these guys going day after day after day or series after series of hand-to-hand combat and living the old men. And can you imagine their bodies? I mean, what did David look like? I mean, we got this idea of this handsome, you know, noble-looking king. But, I mean, the man has been through battle after battle, and they're fighting with swords, and he's not just giving directions. He's up there killing people up until until they pull him off the front lines. So, again, this is a whole different character of people that you sit by in church on Sunday, if you know what I'm saying. It's like the average pastor doesn't want to be David and take his congregation into battle. Like these guys, they may not fit in. And this is a completely different group. So it's just interesting to keep that in mind. That's the box down there about Joab, Abishai, and Ashiel. Also, just because it's interesting, and you're going to get so many names start flying up in here, but we talked about the high priest last week, beginning in 1 Samuel, Eli. Eli had the two wicked sons, Hophni and Phinehas, and they both died when the Philistines invaded there in that battle when they took the ark captive and they overran Shiloh. Well, Phinehas, of course, his wife gives birth to a son named Ichabod the day the tabernacle is burnt, and he kind of disappears from the biblical record. But he does have, apparently, a brother named Ahitub. Ahitub is going to have a couple sons. One is Zadok. That's not going to come up into the story until later. But another named Ahijah, or possibly same guy, is Ahimelech. Definitely Ahimelech. Ahimelech, you know him as the priest that was killed at Shiloh Nob, when David ran from Saul and went up to the Nob where the priests were at, where the 85 priests got slaughtered by Doeg, Saul's shepherd, because David went up there to get some information and get the sword, and he was lying. And Saul just wiped the whole priesthood out, or 85. Ahimelech was the leader there at that time, the high priest. Again, the tabernacle or temple, tabernacle's been burnt. The ark has been taken captive and is in Kiriath-Jearim. So they've got some kind of a sanctuary set up, but that is overrun by Saul. Ahimelech's son, Abiathar, is going to flee as his whole family is being slaughtered by Doeg under Saul's command. Abiathar is going to flee to David in the wilderness, bringing the ephod. The ephod is a garment that it goes over all the priestly outfit. They wear a white linen and they got a tunic. And then the ephod kind of fit over the top of that. It had a breastplate with 12 stones on it. And the ephod then had the two stones in it, the Urim and the Thummim, the two stones that they would take out and ask God questions. It's a mystery. Nobody really knows. The best thing we know about it is there's two stones and they're called the Urim and the Thummim, and they mean lights and perfection. And so what they did, they appeared to ask God questions. You can see sometimes they'll ask, shall we go to battle? It's a yes or no question. So again, the Urim and the Thummim that the priest could have, they could use them like dice. They could be two-sided dice, a yes side and a no side. You roll them, and they both pop up yes, yes. That means yes. They both pop up no, no. That means no, don't go. Or if they pop up yes, no, it means, and then you can see in here, God's not answering. So they do it again, yes, no. You never get a definite roll. That's one idea. That's not definite. Something happened. They reach and they pull these things out and they ask God a question. Lights and perfection. Some people said they are like they would glow or something. But we see very quickly moving into this is they start asking God specific questions, and God doesn't just answer yes or no or go or stay. He starts giving them directions. And so now what we've got coming alongside of this is a prophet or a prophecy. So something, not unless these things are going to speak, which it doesn't say they speak, but somehow you're getting a verbal instruction. Many times it would be assumed that the priest that's using these or in the position of with the ephod is going to then prophesy or speak. They're going to ask God a question, and he's going to speak for God in this communication. The point, Abiathar, when he leaves Nob, when Saul is having all the priests killed, runs to David, as we saw last week in 1 Samuel, bringing the ephod with him. So now David, in those journeys in the wilderness, as he's running from Saul, has the ephod, and he's got direct connection with God, and God is answering him. He's going to continue that practice up when he takes over in the kingdom. Then we're going to see later on tonight, Jonathan is going to be Abiathar's son. That's going to be a kind of like a spy during the civil war between Absalom and David. Also, Ahitub's got a son named Zadok. That's not going to pop up later. But he's got a son named Ahimaaz. And Ahimaaz and Jonathan are going to be kind of partnered up. David's going to actually take the priesthood and split it into two lines. They're going to have the family of Zadok and the family of Ahimelech or Abiathar. That is how David's going to have two priesthoods, and he's going to divide it into the 24 cycles a year. And that's where you can even see that in Zechariah's day in chapter 1 of Luke, where John the Baptist's father was one of the 24 divisions of priests. That division is going to continue. But Zadok, of course, his family's going to come back from captivity and continue that way. Okay, let's go to chapter 1 and page 1 of the maps. That first map that you see on page 1, it looks like this. Here's our map right here. Here's Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea like this, Mediterranean Sea. And we had up here Mount Gilboa. That's where Saul died. Ziglag is over here in the Philistine territory. That's where David was living because he left the land of Judah because Saul's trying to kill him. Saul dies up here. And as you see on that map, you got the arrows of the Philistines going up to the five kings. And eventually, David's going to come back, get sent back to Ziglag. He's not going to join in battle. When he gets back to Ziglag, the city's been overrun. He goes off and pursues the Amalekites, as you can see on the second map on page 1. David, when he gets back, he goes off and pursues them. And Saul's going to die on Mount Gilboa. There's going to be a messenger come back here. And that is where we pick up in chapter 1 of 2 Samuel. Yeah, that's where we are. Page 2 now of the maps. You got some things on here. I may be, so if you would read this verse by verse, these are the names that pop up, like that third map or the first map on page 2. I know it's going to take you a minute to figure out how to turn these things because it's stapled kind of crazy. Does everybody know where we're at? We're on page 2. It's 2 Samuel 1:1 through 2:11. And all those things that are on that map are in those verses somewhere. So if you're reading, you go, I wonder where Gilead's at. Well, it's on there. Well, you can see from Mount Gilboa, a man runs down, takes a couple days to get there, to Ziklag, and tells David, Saul's dead. And that's what chapter 1 is about. He brings him the news, brings him the crown, brings him the bracelet. And he says he saw Saul, and he gives him the conversation there in verse 8. The man ran by Saul on Mount Gilboa. He may have been plundering the dead. He's an Amalekite, and he escapes from the Israelite camp. So he may have been taken captive by Saul, which is interesting. When Saul's supposed to kill the Amalekites, this may have been part of the plunder he brought back, so an Amalekite slave, possibly. We don't know. We know he's an Amalekite. And it says he was escaping from the Israelite camp, and he happened to be going on Mount Gilboa. Well, what do you mean, happened to go? He says right here in verse 6, I happened to be on Mount Gilboa. Well, that's where the Israelites' last stand was, and there was dead bodies all over. And what he's probably doing is just plundering the dead and comes by. It's like, hits the jackpot. Here's the king. And the king, he says, he has a conversation. If this is true or if this is not true, we really don't know. 1 Samuel gave us the impression Saul fell on his sword and died. And that means this man now is lying, that he did not talk with Saul. He just found him. And as he's plundering, grabs the crown and the bracelet and says, hey, I bet I get a better reward from David with this. Or Saul may have fell on his sword and not died right away. And it was as he says right here, if you look in chapter 1, verse 6, the man says, the Amalekite, what can I do? He asked me, who are you? An Amalekite, I answered. Then he said, stand over me and kill me. I'm in the throes of death, but I'm still alive. So I stood over him and killed him because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. And I took the crown, the bracelet, and David asked him all these things. And his men tore their clothes and mourned. And then David comes back after mourning and asks the guy, he says, now tell me, is this what you just said? He says, you weren't afraid to strike the Lord's anointed? He says, I would have been. In fact, David was. He demonstrated that his entire time fleeing in the wilderness. Ordered that this man have his head cut off, and he executed the man. Well, Chapter 1, verse 17 is really one of my favorite parts. I mean, there's so many favorite parts at different levels. But this is David singing a song. It's recorded in the book of Jashar. It says that in verse 18. So we don't have the book of Jashar. We've got the book of Jubilees and some other Israeli recordings of different events. But we don't have this book. We may discover it sometime. It may be in some manuscript form buried somewhere. We may come across it. But nonetheless, this is a song. The book of Jashar seems to be a collection of military hymns or military songs that would encourage the men before battle. And this would be one of them that David wrote, had his men learn. His men would learn this. When David was a great leader, a great general, a great king, because he would train his men in military battle. They would have practice. But they would also have singing. And the singing wasn't just, you know, for fun. The singing was to indoctrinate them to think a certain way. And here it goes, the song, and I really like this song. You won't, then remember, you know what happened to David. He was chased for like 12, 13 years or so by King Saul. At least 8 to 10 years. And Saul's trying to kill him. Destroyed the country trying to kill David. But David is going to sing this song, and he's reflecting back on the glory days. He's remembering when Saul was anointed. He's remembering when Saul was doing the right thing, when he was bringing deliverance. And he did. When Saul became king, Samuel had done some recovery, but he protected him from the Philistines for years. Here we go, verse 19. Your glory, O Israel, lies slain on your heights. Your glory is King Saul. How the mighty have fallen. Tell it not in Gath, that's the Philistine city. Proclaim it not in the streets of Ascalon, that's Philistine. Lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad. We don't want this getting out. This is top secret that Saul's dead. We don't want anybody knowing this. Of course, it's going to get out. Lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. O mountains of Gilboa, may have neither dew nor rain, nor the fields that yield offerings of grain. For there the shield of the mighty was defiled. There the shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. For from the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. Now obviously this is not about the last battle. They both died and they both perished. But here, talking about them in battle, the bow of Jonathan never turned back. And that's true. He never turned back. He died standing with his father. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. When he came back from battle, he always had blood on his sword. Saul and Jonathan, in life, they were loved and gracious. Isn't that interesting? David calls Saul gracious. And in death, they were not parted. And that's, again, a tribute to Jonathan, who knew his father was going to his death and stood. He did what the prince should do. He died with the king. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of a woman. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. In other words, he says, Israel, you've lost your anointed king. You've lost the one who carried you in battle. You are now, well, you've lost your glory. Just like the ark was covered or lost, now the king that was covered in glory is lost. Well, that's the end of that phase right there. It's a great song right there. I'd like to have heard David sing it. Chapter 2. In the course of time, David inquired of the Lord. Now, most likely, this is with the ephod, through the priest. David's just not out, you know, talking to the stars and asking God to speak to him. There's a system of communication. There's a way of going about this. The Lord, he said, shall I go up to one of the towns in Judah? Now, this would be a classic case of the Urim and the Thummim. The Lord said, go up. Yes or no? David asked, where shall I go? Well, now you're getting a little, it's like, how are you going to, what's happening here? He's going to say, to Hebron. And that would be Abraham's old city. So David went with his two wives, and this is just the beginning of his collection of wives, Ahinoam and Abigail. Abigail, again, was the wife of Nabal, who was the one who, we didn't get into the story last week, but he wouldn't provide for David's men, and he died of a heart attack, apparently. There it says right there. David also took his men, and with him they went back up. Now, when David was told that the men of, I'm in verse 4, the men of Jabesh-Gilead, and you can see on that map, the first map on page 2, Jabesh-Gilead is right over there in the land of Gilead on the east side of the Sea of Galilee. And remember the story in the book of Judges when, you remember this? The tribe of Benjamin, stay with me real quick. Back in the book of Judges, the Levite was traveling past Salem or Jerusalem, the Jebusite city, and didn't want to spend the night. Him and his concubine were traveling. He says, I'll get to the land of the Benjamites and stay there. That night his concubine got raped by the men of Benjamin. He gets up this morning, she's dead. He chops her into 12 pieces. They always chop things up. Saul did the same thing. And they sent 12 pieces to the 12 tribes. Says, should such a thing be done in Israel? And so all of Israel said, absolutely not. We're back in the book of Judges. So they all approach Benjamin and they begin to slaughter the Benjamites for this wicked thing they've done. They're trying to fix their culture, I guess. And okay, but nonetheless, they ended up with only 600 men left. So they had them hiding behind a rock and they're about ready to annihilate the tribe of Benjamin. And so the men of Israel said, whoa, wait a minute. We're supposed to have 12 tribes. If we get done today, we're only going to have 11. They said, well, these days there's only 600 left. There's no men, no children, or no women. And we all took a vow that we'll never give our men, our wives to them as our women to them as wives. So what's going to happen? They said, well, let's find out. Is there anybody here that didn't take that vow? And sure enough, Jabesh Gilead never showed up for battle. Well, that they go, they never showed up. Yeah, they never took the vow. Well, now we got two problems. We could use their women for their wives, but we got to kill them because they didn't show up for battle. So they all go march up and kill Jabesh Gilead and a bunch of people there, and they only find 200 women. They bring them back. Say, okay, we got 200 women. 400 guys go, what about me? So that's when they have the Shiloh. Shiloh's right here. They go, Okay, the girls at Shiloh, they have a May Day dance around the Maypole or something like this, some pagan holiday they celebrated there, because they're all Canaanitized. And they said, when they come out to dance around the pole, or they didn't say pole, when they all come out to dance, you guys just hide in the bushes and you 400 just go grab one. And if the dads get upset, we'll talk to them. We'll explain, this is what we need to do. So the 400 guys go, okay. So they all hide in the bushes here, and they all grabbed the wife, and all came home, and there, that's everybody's happy. Okay, we got 600 women for the 600 men. Repopulate your tribe. Well, these people, Jabesh Gilead, 200 women, had come down here. And so remember when Nahash, now this is back in 1 Samuel, Nahash, king of the Amorites, had gone up to attack them. So we're going to gouge out your right eye. They sent messengers where? Down to their family, down to Benjamin. And Saul just happened to be from the tribe of Benjamin. He comes in from the field and says, what's going on? They're going to gouge out our right eye. And all these people are, a bunch of them are related to these people. So they went up, of course, last week and saw Saul's great first battle and delivered the people from Jabesh Gilead from the Ammonites. Now, the reason I said all that, besides it just being a cool story, Saul dies on Mount Gilboa. Beth Shan, right here, is a city. It's on a hill, and it's, nonetheless, he's got a... The Philistines cut Saul's head off and took his armor back to their temples in the Philistia. But they take his son, Jonathan, and Saul's body and hang it on the wall of Beth Shan right here. And when the people of Jabesh Gilead heard about it... Now listen, when the Philistines got down here, they just kept coming. And they just drove Israel out of the land. And that's when Mephibosheth is going to get his legs are going to be injured. That would be... Jonathan's son. The people of Jabesh Gilead go the other way. They come over here and take the body from Saul, or Saul's body off the wall and Jonathan's body, and bring it back to Jabesh Gilead. They burn it because it's been, completely mutilated, and they bury it under a tree here in Jabesh Gilead. So in other words, these people showed tremendous courage, and that's why we're here in chapter 2. Verse 4, when David was told that it was the men of Jabesh Gilead who had buried Saul, he sent messengers to the men of Jabesh Gilead to say to them, the Lord bless you for showing this kindness to Saul your master by burying him. Again, they risked their lives going against the tide in the land of Philistia to take Saul because he was there. They were alive today because of Saul. So again, we can talk about Saul in a negative way, but he did have many things that he did successful, and David remembers those. Jabesh Gilead remembers those. Verse 6, may the Lord now show you kindness and faithfulness, and I too will show you the same favor because you have done this. Now then, be strong and brave, for Saul your master is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me over them. So in other words, David now has claimed, and the men of Judah have selected him to be the king of Judah. This tribe right down in here is Judah. Benjamin's here, and then you got the northern 10 tribes up in here, and they're still under the house of Saul, which we're going to find out is going to be Ish-bosheth, is going to be Saul's son that survived. is going to be the king. Now, we are now in verse 8. Meanwhile, Abner, son of Ner, the commander of Saul's army, had taken Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and brought him to Mahanaim. And now we are on, well, you can see it on that first map or the second map. Mahanaim is a little, not a little, but it's a brook or river that's cut in the rocks here. Mahanaim is over in this area here, and that is where Ishbosheth has been, is living as king over this land. Of course, it's occupied by the Philistines, and Abner's his general. It says in verse 10, Ishbosheth, son of Saul, was 40 years old, and he became king over Israel, and he reigned 2 years. Now, this is something just mentioned real quickly. 2 years. The next thing it says, the house of Judah, however, followed David. The length of time David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7.5 years. So the thing is, Ishbosheth is not going to die until the end of the 7.5 years. So this number, 2 years, means something. Either it took him 5 years to get things settled down so that he could become king for 2 years. Most likely, he was king for 2 years. They anointed him king, and things began to deteriorate. In the last 5 years, you could hardly say he was king. I mean, it was just chaos. They didn't know who was king. But nonetheless, he is king over here in Mahanaim, while David is king down here in Judah. Judah is going to get organized, get their culture back on track. The economy's working again. Everybody's going about. But over in here, they're going to have trouble during this whole time. And so again, Ishbosheth is going to be king actually for 2 years. But there's a 5-year period in there apparently where he was like just not really out of control of the land. Now we can read about that. We got now the battle. If you look on the second map on page 2, what takes place now in the rest of this chapter 2 is from Mahanaim. David is down here in Hebron with Joab, the general. Ishbosheth is over here in Mahanaim with Abner, the general. So you got Abner versus Joab. And they are going to come and they're going to meet. They're going to march off from Mahanaim down here to the land, or in the land right there at Gibeon. And you can see Gibeon right here on your map. And that's the land where the Gibeonites came from when they fooled Joshua with the moldy bread. They came right there from Gibeon. And right there by Gibeon is a very high place, a high mountain. That's where, you know, that's eventually where the tabernacle is going to be set up before it goes into Jerusalem to become the temple. But they're going to meet there, and Joab and Abner, they say, hey, here's what we're going to do. You send 12 men over, and I just made a mistake here a few minutes ago when I said Judah. Benjamin usually goes with Judah, but the thing is, Benjamin obviously is not with Judah now, because Benjamin is the tribe of who? Saul. So if anybody is resisting Judah, it's the tribe of Benjamin. After the fall in 586, when Solomon's empire splits, Benjamin and Judah are going to go south and the other 10 are going to go this way. But at this time, really, here's the barrier. And so nonetheless, what I'm saying here, Joab and Abner get together and they're going to have 12 men from each side meet at this pool. There's some kind of a deep pool there. And they say, hey, they're going to go with a typical Greek-style battle, just like Goliath versus David. The heroes are going to fight, then they'll decide. 12 men from Benjamin or Israel are going to fight against 12 men from Judah, 12 young men. And it doesn't say it specifically here in Scripture, but it appears they're all going to lay down 12 cards, and whoever wins this hand gets the 12 tribes. It's like they're trying to decide who's in control of the land. And so this little skirmish right here, this little hero, 12 potentially represents the 12 tribes. Whoever wins this will win the control of the leadership. So what we've got here, let's look in verse 14. Then Abner said to Joab, let's have some of the young men get up and fight hand to hand. All right, let them do it, Joab said. So they stood up and were counted off, 12 men from Benjamin and Ishbosheth, son of Saul, and 12 for David. So it's 12 verse 12. Then each man, now this is kind of a weird story. Then each man grabbed his opponent by the head and thrust his dagger into his opponent's side, and they fell down together. It's kind of like a wrestling match. They all get a hold of each other with their daggers, and when they say go, they all stab the other guy, and all 24 of them drop down dead. It's like, that didn't decide anything. Well, then what happens then, Joab, men of Benjamin, men of Judah, then they enter into a battle and they start fighting. And here we got mentioned verse 18, the three sons of Zeruiah were there, Joab, Abishai, and Ashiel. Now, Ashiel was fleet-footed. And this story now talks about, this is going to play out in a little bit later as being important as far as what takes place. But Ashiel, David's nephew, the younger one, ends up seeing Abner away from the group, maybe in some kind of a retreat, but he starts chasing him. He doesn't appear to have any armor with him. Maybe he does. But he's chasing Abner, and Abner is running away. And Abner hollers back. You can read it here. Hollers back, goes, Abishai, or Ashiel. He says, turn around and go find somebody. Take some armor from some of the young men. In other words, maybe he's saying, why don't you go fight somebody you can compete with? Don't be chasing me. Or maybe he's saying, instead of chasing me, why don't you stop and pick up some armor and then continue the pursuit? But don't come at me with no armor. But anyway, Ashiel is pursuing him, and he won't quit. So Abner just stops, waits for him, and then takes his sword, so here, and just takes the end of his sword or his spear and sticks it through him and kills him. It's like, what are you doing, kid? I mean, Abner was running, trying to. He looked at him and says, I will never be able to see Joab face to face if I kill his brother like this. But Ashiel wouldn't quit and killed him. And it says right there, when all the men came and saw Ashiel laying there, they stopped pursuing. And Abner ends up getting all of his men on a hill, kind of regrouping on a hill. Joab comes to the hill. They're going to have another battle. And finally, Abner and Joab, they say, hey, this is never going to quit. Let's call it off. And Joab says, a good thing you said that. Otherwise, we would have destroyed you tonight. And so that night, they called the battle off. And Abner and Israel marched back to Mahanaim. And that night, Joab and the men of Judah marched back to Hebron. And as the count was all done, the tribe of Judah had slaughtered, had really, if you were keeping score, was winning the battle. And they just stopped because, well, the thing is, they're all relatives. It's kind of like the Civil War. It's the North versus the South. It's like, we're going to win. And when we get done winning, we're going to just have killed our own families. So that kind of how that ends up. Chapter 3, that says in verse 1, the war between the house of Saul and the house of David lasted a long time. Well, 7.5 years. This thing was going on at some kind of level. David grew stronger and stronger while the house of Saul grew weaker and weaker. And I think that would be the verse that would explain the 2 years and the 7 years. David started off for 7 years and grew stronger and stronger and reigned for 7.5 years. Ish-bosheth and the house of Saul started off, and that within the first 2 years, they just got weaker and weaker until they'd have nothing to stand for. It gives you a list of all of David's, not all, but a list of David's wives and some of his sons. In verse 2, Abnon, who's going to be the son who's going to end up raping his sister and getting killed by her brother, Absalom. Keliab, in verse 3, we don't know anything about him. He may have died young. Absalom, the one who's going to kill Abnon and then lead a revolt against David. Adonijah, who we're not going to hear anything from until the end of 2 Samuel and 1 Kings, when he is going to claim the throne as his father is dying. But Solomon has been announced to be the king and kind of prophesied to be the king. But Adonijah is going to take with him, he's going to take the high priest Abiathar and Joab. Or did you hear what I just said? David's high priest Abiathar and Joab are going to say, you know what? I think Adonijah is the one we're voting for. Are you watching Iran? Kind of like that. And so they're over here having this announcement party that we've won this election. It wasn't an election. They're just going to take over when David dies. David's breathing his last. And Bathsheba comes in and says, David, didn't you say my son Solomon would be king? And he goes, yes. He goes, oh, you should probably want to do something about it. So then they get Zadok the priest, Benaiah, one of David's mighty men, and they anoint Solomon and bring him in and to the city and beat Adonijah to the punch and have an official, where he rides David's donkey and stuff. And that ends up putting Joab and Abiathar on the wrong side, and both of them are going to be executed by Solomon. So it's just kind of interesting how that all works out. But then there's a couple other ones mentioned there again. Abner now, in verse 6. Abner goes over to David. In the verses 6 through about 9, what happens right there is as you can see this other places, is when a king dies or is there some kind of a revolt, if a man can, as a sign of his authority, can get the king's wife or get the king's concubine, it's kind of like a sign, I've got the king's, everything the king had, including his wife, so I've got his power. Well, Abner ends up sleeping with one of Saul's concubines. And you can see right here, Ishbosheth in verse 7 says, why did you sleep with my father's concubine? Rispa is her name. There's the word hot is in that. Rispa, there's the word hot is in there. But nonetheless, Abner was very angry because of what Ishbosheth says. Ishbosheth says, why did you sleep with her? And Abner doesn't say, I didn't. He says, why don't you just get back on your throne and sit down, because I'm pretty much running the show. In other words, He knows he's running the show. The general Abner's running the show, and the general Joab, you're going to see him almost running the show down here for David a couple times. Well, anyway, when that made him mad, and he says, "Am I just a dog's head on Judah's side? This very day I am loyal to the house of your father Saul and to this family and friends. I haven't handed you over to David, yet now you accuse me of an offense involving this woman. May God deal with Abner, be it ever so severely, if I do not do for David," are you ready? "If I do not do for David what the Lord promised him on oath and transfer the kingdom from from the house of Saul and establish David's throne forever." You understand? The Philistines knew this prophecy. Saul knew the prophecy. David and his men knew the prophecy. Now Abner, the general for the Israelites, for Ishbosheth, they know David. There's a prophecy that David is going to be the one over the house. It's going to unite the house of Israel. And I don't know if they're just waiting for time or, you know, eschatological. We don't know when it's going to happen. But here he says, all right, he says, fine, we'll do it now. If that's where you want to be, Ishbosheth. Then verse 12, then Abner sent messengers on behalf to say to David, "Whose land is it? Make an agreement with me and I will help you bring all Israel over to you." When he says, "Whose land is it?" he says, there's a note from Abner. Who runs the land? Who controls Israel? In other words, he's saying, it's me and I'm telling you, I'll give it to you. Are you ready? So that's how Abner was thinking about himself, and that's probably, again, Ishbosheth is completely out of touch. Or not out of touch, but out of power. "Good," said David, "I will make an agreement with you, but I demand one thing of you." Watch this. Now remember what I said about the wives. "Do not come into my presence unless you bring Michal," some people say Michael, either way, "daughter of Saul, when you come to see me." In other words, Michal, his wife, that was the daughter of Saul, when he started running, she was taken and given to somebody else. He says, "You don't cross my border until you bring her back, because I don't want a wife of David up there living with another man who's going to be able to claim some kind of power or authority over me. Bring her back." Well, you can see he brings her back, and her husband, verse 15, "So Ishbosheth gave orders and had her taken away from her husband, Paltiel, a son of Laish," whatever. And it says he followed her crying as Abner's coming down here, Galilee, Jordan, Dead Sea, here's the border. They're over here in Mahanaim. He picks her up, comes down to Hebron, and her husband follows her crying until right just north of Jerusalem, kind of when they cross the border into Judah. And Abner turns and says, "Go back home." And he turns and says he leaves. But she just got taken from her husband, and they apparently had a family. Well, anyway, it says Abner conferred with the elders of Israel. So now Abner, right, is down here. Now, our map that we've got is on page 3. Yep, the next map on page 3. Down here, Joab has gone on a raiding party. So Joab is just, you know, they're just out raiding. That's what their job is. We go out and steal stuff. Kind of like pirates, I guess. But they're out raiding, you know, the Amalekites or the rest of the Philistine cities or whatever. And while he's out raiding, Abner comes down and has a meeting with David and pretty much makes an agreement. "I'll give you the kingdom. All right, then here we go." Probably there's going to be some kind of a position that Abner will receive. Well, Abner then leaves, and Joab comes in. They say, "Hey, Joab, guess who was here? Abner." And he talked with David. Oh, this isn't good. And it may not be good. This is one case right here where Joab, and again, he's going to kill him. Why would Joab want to kill Abner? Well, he's a general and maybe threatening his position. But as we're going to read on, if we'd read on here, he's going to kill him for vengeance for having killed his brother. Remember, he stuck the sword, the end of the spear through. So Abner's already left. Joab sends men to go, "Hey, we got to talk." So Abner figures in another official meeting, comes back, and he meets with him in the gate with no one around, gives him a hug, kind of like, and sticks him with a dagger. And David now, you can see that's in chapter 3, at the end of chapter 3. David curses him in verse 28, 29. And David, during the funeral, David makes it very clear. He won't eat. He's fasting. He orders everybody to walk in front of the funeral procession. He himself walks behind it, making sure everybody knows, and he's crying. So it's a good, one, he's upset. He gets mad at Joab because Joab killed this man in innocent blood. But one of the things David does here is makes a very clear political statement. "I am not," to Israel. He goes, they've just handed this over to him. Abner just handed him the kingdom. Well, their man, Abner, who's running the show, gets killed down here in Hebron. That's going to make it a little less likely that they're going to want to come down here and cooperate. So David makes a very clear show, this was not me, and he rejects it and curses his general. The thing is, what I wonder as I read through this, why did he never just fire Joab? And you know why, I think? He couldn't. Joab's the general. Joab command. You know, we read David, we go, well, David's a mighty man. Everybody loves David. Indeed. Except he's going to have, they're going to have a civil war. The whole nation's going to rebel against him and drive him out of the land. Just, we ended 2 Samuel with his men getting ready to stone him. So, I mean, David is a political figure. He's got poll numbers going up and down. But Joab, no matter where the polls are at, he's got a military behind him. And David realizes, if I've got Joab on my side, I've got a military behind me. I mean, you hate to think that. You just want to think David is a great king and everybody loves David. But he's going to have a civil war. In his middle of his reign, he's going to have a civil war. They're going to drive him out, and he's going to be brought back in. So Joab has some power. That's, I think, why David never just finally just kills Joab. And he's going to have Solomon do it. One of his last words to Solomon, if we hear him get there, he tells Solomon, do not let Joab's gray head go to the grave in peace. In other words, I'm going to die. Don't let him die. You kill him first. Because when I die, he is going to be problems. And you can kill him. Because a new king, new reign, you can execute him and start over. Well, nonetheless, chapter 4 talks about Ishbosheth. A couple guys come up and they cut off a couple of his raiders, leaders of his raiding parties. They cut off Ishbosheth's head, bring it down to David, thinking, guess what? Big rewards. And he says, you know what I did to the guy that brought me King Saul's crown and his bracelet? I killed him. What do you think I'm going to do to you? And he had them executed. Then chapter 5, all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron. That means all the northern tribes came to at Hebron. And they said to him, we are your own flesh and blood. In the past, while Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel on all their military campaigns. And the Lord said, watch what the people say. And the Lord said to you, you will shepherd my people Israel, and you will become their ruler. And that is like the fourth time we've heard that. Everybody knows that. This is the prophecy. And David's just got this prophecy driving his life. So they come down, and they say, listen, when we followed Saul, you were the general. You were the one that led us in battle until Saul got mad. So he said, this isn't so strange. We're your flesh and blood. We're your brothers. You used to be our general. This is not that strange of a thing. We're going to hand our kingdom over to you. When all the elders of Israel had come to David at Hebron, the king made a compact with them. Verse 4, David was 30 years old when he became king. Now, again, I think that's not when he became king of Israel. That's when he became king down here. He was king for 7.5 years. So I would say he's 37.5. If you say he's 30 now, and you take said, that means he was 23 years old when he became king of Hebron. Then he was chased by Saul for at least 8 years. So now you got him back. You know, he was a general for killing, you know, leading people in battle when he was 14. All possible. But again, as you put this together, it just makes sense. 37.5 years now, and he's going to go until he's 70 years old. So he's going to be a king in Hebron or in Israel for a period of 40 years. And that's what that verse says there. Now, first thing he does, at verse 6, the king and his men marched to Jerusalem to attack the Jebusites. And again, it's amazing to realize this, that after all Joshua and Caleb have been through the land, all the judges have been through the land, Saul and Samuel have been through the land, the Philistines have overrun the land a couple times, they've all got the land back. In fact, David has been ruling for 7.5 years in Hebron, down here in the land of Judah. Here's Hebron. But there's a city right here. It's the Jebusite city, Jebusite, and the name of the city is Jebus, or Jabus, and it's called Jerusalem, eventually, but that's the city. It's Melchizedek city, but nonetheless, that city has never been taken. But the thing is, it's right there on the border between Benjamin and Judah, and it's just going to be, again, another good political move, plus David grew up 5 miles south of there in Bethlehem, knowing, what are they doing there? These are Jebusites in the Lord. Remember how he talked to Goliath? You uncircumcised Philistine, meaning uncircumcision means you have no covenant. You have no right to be in this land. What are you mouthing off to God's people for? Well, that's how he talked to the Philistines. What do you think about he grew up in the shadow of Jerusalem thinking, what are they still doing there? And that's maybe one of the reasons he buried Goliath's head there. He killed Goliath, and where does he take it? Over there, indicating one, there's something about Jerusalem or Jabesh that David's been thinking about. Either they don't belong here, we need to drive those people out to fulfill the covenant or the promise. Or he's thinking, that's the site of Moriah, Mount Moriah. That's where God's home is going to be. That's going to be God's city. Or he's thinking now, it's just a good political place. You know, it's in the middle of the borders right there. But nonetheless, he did, after killing Goliath, place Goliath's head there, meaning he's thinking about this. Well, he marches up, and we've talked about this story before. You can't get in the city. We went, a couple weeks ago, we went through the whole landscape around this, so we won't waste our time there. But you can't, it's on a, surrounded by valleys. There's only one place to get in there from the north, and that's where the fortresses are. They just stand there and defend one part of the city. You're going to have to scale up a steep wall coming out of the Kidron Valley or the Hinnom Valley. And then on top of that, they've got the Jebusite or the Canaanite walls on top of that. You can't just run up to the city and attack it. You can't do it. And they say right there the Jebusites were in verse, 6? The Jebusites said to David, "You will not get in here." So David marches out, and they look at him, "You will not get in here. Joshua didn't get in here. Caleb didn't get in here. None of the judges got in here. Samuel never got in here. You know, Saul didn't get in here. Why are you different?" They say, "You will not get in here. Even the blind and the lame can ward you off." And that meaning, we just get some people in wheelchairs here with some bows and arrows that are here on the north side and just shoot at you. It's like, what are you going to do? We just keep shooting you as you run towards us. We don't even have hand-to-hand combat. The lame people can defend us. David cannot get in here, they says. Nevertheless, David captured the fortress of Zion, the city of David. Now, notice it's called the city of David. And again, we talked about that before. That's the part that he conquered right down there. The city's going to expand. That is called, even today, it's called the city of David. It's not the old city of Jerusalem where the walls are at. It's south of there, the city of David. Of course, Bethlehem is also called the city of David because that's where he was born. And here's what he says. On that day, verse 8, on that day, David said, "Anyone who conquers the Jebusites will have to use the water shaft." And that's the Gihon Springs. And there's water comes in there. They have to drop their buckets down there from inside the city. And someone's going to have to shimmy up there with a special ops team and get into the city and open the gates. The Trojan horse type of story, except a little bit different. And that is exactly, Joab does that. In fact, David, I don't know if it says it here. I think it's in 1 Chronicles. David says, "Whoever takes the city will be my general." So he's trying to open up. Hey, if anybody wants to take it, and Joab says, "I'll do it." And so Joab does it, and he's still the general. David trying to maybe get rid of him, and he does it. Well, anyway, he takes the city, and they talks about in verse 9, they build the city up, they add to the terraces, they build outside the city, they clean the city up. David's going to build himself a fortress up there on the north side, and his palace is up there on the north side. Now, again, we've talked about this many weeks ago. They have found David's palace. They're excavating David's palace. The whole city of David's only 10 acres. And you know where the fortress, it talks about his fortress, and he talks about he went from the palace up to the fortress so that they're right beside each other. So once you figure out where the fortress is, which is on the north side of the city, the palace is like right here. But now there's people living on top of it, and you've got to, you know, work with all the situations, the political situations. But they finally now, and they couldn't start digging there until 67, you know what I'm saying, because Israel didn't have occupation. The last thing the Muslims want to find is David's palace in Jerusalem. You know what I'm saying? Because they don't want to say the Jews never even were there until 1948 when the United States put them there. Okay, that's another whole story. But nonetheless, they are excavating David's palace, and they found, a lot of evidence that it is that. And we've talked about that. Now, David's in Jerusalem, verse 11. Now, Hiram, let's see if we figure out where we're at. Page 4. Go to page 4 on your maps. Is there? I don't see. Well, I think it's on page 3, but we'll stay right here. Hiram's up there in Tyre. Hiram's the king. He sees David's in position of authority now. That David's definitely doing something up here in Tyre, a little bit further north than on my map here. And Hiram sends messengers down and says, "Hey, can we help you build up some city or your city here?" And David ends up floating logs down here from Hiram and hires workers from the Phoenicians up here. And they build him a palace, good woodworkers. Solomon's going to do the same thing when he builds the palace, or the temple. And he establishes himself. And when David sees this, he realizes he has been established as king. Now, in chapter 5, verse 17, it's the first of two Philistine battles that are recorded. And it's on page 4. There's two maps on page 4. The first one talks about this battle right here. And the second one talks about the second map right there. And it says, watch this, verse 17. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they went up in full force to search for him. They realized that David's going to try and they've been overrunning the Israelites on and off now for hundreds of years. They say, well, we've got to take out David. They go up to look for him. But David heard about it and went down to the stronghold. That would probably be Masada. Now the Philistines had come and spread out over the Valley of Rephaim. And you can see right there on that map, Valley of Rephaim. They're right in there ready to attack David. David's outside Jerusalem now. And so David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go and attack the Philistines? Will you hand them over to me?" The Lord answered, "Go, for I will surely hand the Philistines over to you." So David went and defeated them. Verse 22. Once more, the Philistines came up and spread out in the land, or in the Valley of Rephaim. That's the second map now. So David inquired of the Lord, and he answered, "Do not go straight up, but circle around behind them and attack them in front of the balsam trees. As soon as you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, move quickly, because that will mean the Lord has gone out in front." So in other words, he circles around the balsam trees. Remember how Elisha in 2 Kings is going to be able to see, or he says, open Gehazi's eyes, or open his servant's eyes, so he could see the angels that had surrounded the city. They saw into the spiritual realm and saw the angels, the fiery horses and the fiery chariots. David here doesn't see them. He does what? Hears them. It's like we're waiting. What we're waiting for? We're waiting for God's army to go. And pretty soon they're waiting. All of a sudden, you know, they hear. They say, "Oh, look, the wind was blowing the leaves." David knows the sound of a marching army compared to the sound of wind blowing through leaves. Do you think it sounds different? If you're sitting on your deck and you hear the wind blowing the leaves, you just continue to sit on your deck and enjoy it. But if you hear the sound of an army marching in the leaves, you're going to go inside, I would think, or at least maybe run. So when he hears an army marching over the trees, David says, "The Lord has gone out." It wasn't just wind, you know. Okay. How would you like to follow a man like that in battle? Boys, we're going to sit here until we hear the leaves blow. It's like, I think David, when they're sitting there, we're going to march when we hear the Lord marching. And all of a sudden, I hear it, and they go, "Well, it's time to go." And they went to battle with the Lord. And that's very typical of a battle with the Lord. That's how it was with Moses. It was that way with Joshua. It was that way. We're going to see with some of the other kings. Okay, now David's a little bit about the Philistines there. Chapter 6, David again brought together out of Israel, chosen men, 30,000 in all, and he had his men go up from Baal to Judah, bring up from there the ark. So he said, "We want the ark. The next thing is going to bring the ark." And the ark now, again, we've already talked about the story the last couple of weeks, referring to it, but it's in Kiriath-Jearim, and he's going to bring it up there. And as they begin to bring it, they throw it in a cart with the oxen. And that's not at all how God wanted it done. And you can see here in verse 3 in chapter 6, they set the ark of God on a new cart, just like the Philistines did. And again, a good lesson right here, it's so obvious, is you cannot imitate the Canaanite culture. You can't change. When God gives you instruction, when God shows you how to do something, you need to follow God's pattern, not follow the pattern of the world. Now, that doesn't refer to, you know, rock and roll music, or you can have a rock and roll Christian, so I mean, whatever, you know what I'm saying? You can get stretched out of that too. But when God says, "This is how we do something, this is how you do it." Well, they put it on the cart just like the Philistines put it on the cart, and it didn't work. And brought it from the house of Abinadab, remember, there it's been in Abinadab's house, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, his sons of Abinadab, were guarding the new cart, or guiding the new cart. And it's going to rock a little bit, the ark's going to come off a little bit, and Uzzah is going to reach up and touch it, and he's going to drop dead. And David's going to say, "Why has this happened?" And it's going to sit there. He says, they're going to take it into, because he's afraid. He says, "I don't understand this. God's now killing these men." And so they're going to leave the house of Obed-Edom, who is a Gittite, living just right outside of the city of Jerusalem, right in that area there. And the ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom, the Gittite, for 3 months. So David is going to spend 3 months, and at first he doesn't know. He says, "Who can do this? We can't move the ark." So now he's going to wait. And during that 3 months period, apparently he went to the priest, the Levites, got some study done and figured out this is how we're supposed to carry the Ark of the Covenant. And they come back and they carry it exactly the right way from Obed-Edom's house. I mean, in fact, you see in verse 12. Now King David was told, verse 12, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because the Ark of God. Just like when it was in the land of the Philistines, it brought the hemorrhoids and the rats and they got rid of it. Obed-Edom brings it in, and God says, "I like it here. I like Obed-Edom. It's a nice place. I'm going to bless it." And they say, David, the ark, it's Obed-Edom. He's blessed. Then we got to get the ark. So they studied, they got the ark into Jerusalem. And he talks about that. And you can see right there, this is when Michal, his wife that was brought back, looks out the window, sees him dancing before the Lord, and talks about probably what he was doing is, remember, Michal grew up as the daughter of King Saul, and then she married young as one of the leading generals of Israel, David. And so she only knows royalty. She only knows this position of princess. Well, David, he's a shepherd, and he's the youngest of the family. He's a warrior. He was delivering food to his brothers. He's all these things. He's just another guy. And so when this happens, he's dancing. It says right here, verse 20, when David returned home to bless his house, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and says, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today. Oh, you've really made a good impression setting yourself up as nobility today, disrobing in the sight of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." Now again, this robing doesn't mean stripping down and dancing, vulgar dancing. Vulgar means common. I mean, it means what he did here was when she looked out the window and she's in her royal position watching the common people celebrate in the streets, you know, with her servants around her, it's like, oh my gosh, is that my husband? It's like, he should be standing up here with me observing the crowd. Instead, he's down there dancing like any common fellow. You haven't even distinguished yourself. You look like everybody else. And David says, "You haven't seen anything yet." He says, and it goes, on, and it says he didn't see her anymore. God's promise to David. Now, one night in the palace there in Jerusalem, things have settled down. David's sitting around there having a Coke with his prophet Nathan, just talking, and they were talking about, well, how's the fishing? Pretty good. Well, how's the military doing? Oh, having a great day over there in Moab. Yeah, I had a great time. Well, hey, you know what I was thinking? What were you thinking? I'm thinking about doing a little addition here. I'm thinking about, you know, I got this nice palace, you know, nice woodwork, men of Tyre, about done with everything we got here. And God's ark that we brought is just sitting out there in a little tent that everybody, they've got people singing in front of it all the time. They've got the priests that are ministering to it, but it's not with the tabernacle. The tabernacle now is up here, and it's no longer at Nob. Remember, Nob got run over. It's now here just south of Gibeon, on that high place right here where Solomon is going to meet God, and when he's going to have that vision or that dream, eventually it's going to be transferred down to the temple. That's where the tabernacle, per se, would be. But the ark is down here in Jerusalem, just in a tent. He said, I'm going to build God a house. I'm going to build a temple. And Nathan, taking another sip of his Coke, says, you know, that's a good idea. We ought to do that. These guys are about down here with the palace. What do you think it'd look like? Oh, I've got some things drawn up here. Spent the rest of the evening talking about this house that David is going to build. Nathan goes, well, hey, I better get home. It's a great idea. And he left. Well, now it goes right here. That night, verse 4, that night the word of the Lord came to Nathan saying, go and say, now remember, this was just the prophet just talking to the king over a Coke. Now, again, it doesn't say they're having Coke, but you know, I'm just, you know, make it look like a casual conversation. Read it yourself, make your own story up. But nonetheless, it says, go and tell my servant David, this is what the Lord says. Are you the one to build a house to dwell in? In other words, God has now moved in on the conversation and says, prophet, you go tell him as the prophet, you're not going to be building this. That someone else is going to do it. You're a warrior. You're the one to establish the kingdom. You're not the one that's going to build this house. Well, David ends up, actually, by the end of time, his life is over. He's got all the plans made up. All the blueprints are done. They've got all the building materials piled up in stock. It looks like Home Depot there in Jerusalem, just waiting. Kind of like it does today, if you would, in certain areas where they got all the stuff ready for the temple. They're just ready. Talk about the temple. They could go thrown together overnight, just about. I mean, they are ready to build. They're just waiting. Just waiting. Well, David did everything he could except build it. Well, then it continues here. You can see there's a long section here that God is speaking to Nathan. I'm in verse 11. The Lord declares to you that the Lord himself will establish a house for you. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will raise up your offspring to succeed you. Now, we don't have time to teach this. Again, it's kind of fun to teach these next verses, but I'll tell you what's happening. It's one of those double prophecies. Now, again, I teach, and I proper hermeneutics is when something is written, it only has one meaning. There may be many applications, but when Paul writes something, he means one thing. You understand what I'm saying? You can't say, well, it means four or five things. It only means one thing. But when you get into prophecy, prophecies can have, they can say one thing, but be talking about two different times. And we see that often, sometimes three times. Can have an immediate fulfillment in, like, you know, the locusts are coming. It can have a fulfillment in the time of the coming of the Christ the first time in the Gospels. And then there can be an ultimate fulfillment in the days of the tribulation or when Jesus returns. So there can be up to, you know, maybe more, but there can be three fulfillments because it was that's what it was written. It was written to mean three different times this is going to happen. Also in the book of John sometimes, like when he uses certain words like light, they sometimes have double meanings. Yes, we're talking about physical light, but John was also wanting to look at spiritual. I mean, but that's on purpose. You understand what I'm saying? That's an intentional double meaning. So, but right here is a typical case where it's two things. He's talking about Solomon, but he's also talking about Jesus, or the Son that's going to come. When your days are over and you rest with your fathers, I will, notice the word, raise up your offspring to succeed you. Raise up, you know, if you've been around Easter ever, it's kind of a buzzword for Easter, who will come from your own body, both Solomon and Jesus, and I will establish his kingdom. Solomon's was established, but Jesus is going to be established forever. He is the one who will build a house for my name. Well, Solomon did that, but Jesus is going to do it again. And again, now you can have that three-pronged fulfillment, if you would. Solomon built the temple, but Jesus, he says, I will build my church. He is currently building his body, his temple. He's building the church. Talks about stones. He's building the church. But ultimately, Jesus is going to build a temple, the millennial temple where he'll rule and reign. So again, you can see that three-pronged, again, triple meaning right there. If you would allow that. And I have no trouble with that hermeneutically because I think that's possibly what it could mean. And actually, no one of those three actually fulfills everything said here, if you read it. But again, I don't want to teach this right now because we got to go. He is the one who will build a house for my name, and I will establish the throne of his kingdom. Now it says, forever. Now again, you know, now what are you talking about? I will be his father, and he will be my son. Now clearly, this is a reference to Jesus because different places, the book of Hebrews uses this to refer to Jesus Christ. So now it's using this as a reference to Jesus. When he does wrong, when he does wrong, I will punish him with the rod of men. It's like, well, now it can't be Jesus. And it is Solomon, because that's going to happen to Solomon. With the rod of men and with floggings inflicted by men. Except one of the things I got, Adam Clark and Bishop Horsky right here, they translate it this way. When iniquity is laid up on him, I will punish him with the rods of men. So again, Solomon committed the iniquity, but Jesus, the iniquity was laid upon him, and the result was the same. Flogging inflicted by men and the rods of men. So Solomon got, we're going to see by the end of Solomon's time, raiders and armies are coming in to punish Solomon for his iniquity. But clearly, you know the story of Jesus. Iniquity was laid on him, and he received the punishment for sin. But my love will never be taken away from him as I took it away from Saul, whom I removed before you. Your house and your kingdom will endure forever before me. Your throne will be established forever. And what you just read right there, you're going to want to mark that in your Bibles, is the Davidic covenant. Just like you should have Genesis chapter 12, the Abrahamic covenant, where God says, I'll give you a nation. Later on, he's going to talk about the land. Here is the Davidic covenant. You will have a son ruling forever. And again, that's, you know, for us as Christians, that's just screaming Jesus Christ. That's he is the one. He came, he fulfilled, you know, the iniquity is laid on him. He was raised up. He's building the church. He's going to build his temple eventually, and his kingdom will reign forever, and he's going to sit on the throne of David. Okay, Nathan reported to David all the words of the entire revelation. Verse 18, then David went in and sat before the Lord. Now, what you have right here, again, I got to quit. But now this is getting exciting right here. Verse 18. That was a huge prophecy. The Davidic covenant was just spoken to David. Now, just read this verse. You know, as I read this again, there's a word in here that is not right. It's correct Hebrew. It's the right translation. But we just read through it. I just read through it. But there's a word right here that's like, wait a minute. Then King David went in and sat before the Lord, and he said, who am I, O Solomon? Do you know what was wrong right there? Sat. No one sits in front of the Lord. The priests don't sit. They minister. They're always standing. But Jesus, when he was resurrected, went in and is seated at the right hand of God. And David, apparently, again, you don't want to put too much into it, but it is very unique. David, in response to this, goes in and sits before the Lord. Doesn't stand and minister before the Lord, or he sits as if the work is finished. as if this is his place, as if in fulfillment, as if as a sign or a type of the ultimate Son of David, Jesus Christ, he sits in front of the Lord or before the Lord. Again, that's a very, very, you know, that's not normal. But and I don't want to make too much out of it. At the same time, it's one of those things that you maybe should make something out of it. And then you got David's prayer about how thankful he is and how he understands it. He understands what God has said to him. And realizing as we come out of the book of Judges and during 1 Samuel, how the word of the Lord was very rare. To have this kind of revelation at this time is huge. And to have a man that can wrap his mind around it is a very unique situation. Well, we are in chapter 8. And it's been a while. So, you know, Aaron, I don't know. We're slowing down. I'm going to pray, and then if you have any questions, feel free to ask some questions. Okay. Father, we do thank you for your truth. We thank you for your word. We thank you that it is precise, that it is informative, but Father, also it provides us with spiritual guidance, wisdom that we can live our lives by, and also reveals who you are, your plans, your character, and how you deal with people in history. We do ask that we may be a people who walk in your light, walk in your truth. And again, we thank you for this chance to be here tonight. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Hey, thank you so much for being here. We will be here next week again in chapter 8. Any questions? You're free to leave. Grab a book if you don't have a book, or if you got something you want to give a book to, grab some CDs if you want CDs. And don't forget to go online. All the other Bible schools are all online. The maps are online. All the notes are online. The videos are online. You just got to figure it out. And if you can figure out a better way of doing it, let me know. Questions at all? All right, have a nice night. Thank you for coming.